This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Today we return to part two of our conversation with my guest, Dr. Elijah Anderson, the Charles and William L. Day Professor of the Social Sciences and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, author of several books, including the well-known Code of the Street, Decency, Violence, and the Moral Life of the Inner City. Welcome back, and thanks for this second interview, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, in our last program, we discussed a number of key issues affecting city life, and you've written this book, and let's talk about the book, Code of the Street, because it's such a marvelous work, and it's a seminal work in this field, really. How has doing that book affected what happened to you as you were going through actually doing the book and living the experiences? What was it like for you?
Well, my work builds on the work, on previous work that I've done. And in some sense, this book started back when I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago when I did my first study, A Place on the Corner. I spent 3 years on one street corner on the south side of Chicago at a bar, liquor store, getting to know the men. And I wrote about their lives in this book. I like to think that I was able to render something of their social reality in this book. And of course, that world 30-some years ago was very different from the world we see today. If anything, the life was more benign. The edge was there, but not quite like the edge is there today. Over the course of that 3-year period, 9 people died. They died of various things, from violence to illness to whatever it was. I got to know this 55-member group of men pretty well, and I got to know the wineheads, the hoodlums, and the regulars. In many ways, the later work I did was adumbrated in the concepts that I was able to develop in this early work. Now, this issue of decency, street, it was there in embryo form in this earlier work. And later in Philadelphia, I wrote a book called Streetwise, which is all about life in a gentrifying community bordered by a very, very poor area of Mantua, Powelton and Mantua. And I did that work back in the late 80s, mid-80s and late 80s. Actually, Streetwise was the title. Later, I did the book Code of the Street, which in some ways was a sequel to Streetwise, with more of an emphasis on why so many of the young people are killing each other. That was a big question for me. And it was a big public policy question at the time. It still is. The book attempts to speak to that issue, but even more broadly to the issue of social organization of inner-city communities. And that's what I've tried to do in this book.
Take us through the part of the book where you actually, I mentioned it in the last show, go down Germantown Avenue, because I've been so aware that when you start at one end, it's a whole different world until you get to the bottom part of it.
That's right. Well, at the top of the hill, the Germantown Avenue, is Chestnut Hill. And Chestnut Hill is one of the most prestigious residential areas of the city. And Germantown Avenue is an old road that goes back to revolutionary days. And it's a main artery that goes through the city of Philadelphia, coming in from the northwest, all down the avenue, all the way to the river. And I thought this would be a good way to show the various neighborhoods and the changes that beset so many different kinds of neighborhoods in Philadelphia, which is one of the reasons I decided to do it just that way. I walked the streets of Germantown Avenue I walked up and down the avenue so many times. I drove up and down the avenue so many times. I hung out in Starbucks and other places at the top of the avenue and got to know many of the people there. And on down the avenue, things change up. I hung out at some of the basketball courts, the library there, even the supermarket there in Mount Airy. And I walked the streets there, the various restaurants, barbershops. I used to get my hair cut at the barbershops along Germantown Avenue there in Mount Airy. And then further down, Sheldon Avenue, the barbershops, and I would stop there and get my hair cut. And I'd visit the places where women would get their hair done, and I would check out the parks nearby. And I'd walk Sheldon Avenue as well, up and down Sheldon Avenue. All times of the day and night I would spend time writing field notes, observing, talking to people who talked to me, but checking out the scene and trying to apprehend, comprehend, understand, and ultimately represent that situation. So that's kind of what you see in the introduction to the book, down Germantown Avenue. And beyond that, you see that there's a code of civility at one end of the avenue, that is Chestnut Hill. And as you get down the avenue to some of the poor sections of the city, you see the code of the street in operation, full blown. And that's kind of the theme of the book. And it focuses on this code of the street, which is a set of rules that people live by in order to have a certain modicum, at least, of safety and security about themselves, they think. And the code of the street becomes kind of a policing mechanism. It puts an order to things. And people understand just by growing up, you somehow gain some understanding of this code, and that following this code, operating by this code, to some extent helps you to understand the streets. But at the same time, if you observe it correctly, it promises to keep you safe.
It's interesting, again, as a youngster out of New York, I remember we always said I had different kinds of friends. The kids on the corner were very different than the ones maybe I went to school with, mm-hmm. or the ones that I went to church with. And you adapted your method of interacting mm-hmm. based on some of the expectations that they may have had of you or how you are accepted. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is the same conceptual framework that we're talking about. How do you survive mm-hmm. in various areas and all?
Yeah, and one of the things that comes out of the book is the premium placed on knowing what time it is, not by the clock, but socially. Because to know what time it is to know how to behave in order to survive, so that people try to meet the exigencies of life according to the situation they find themselves in. And to do this effectively, what they do is code switch. You know, mm-hmm. there's a need to read the situation to know how best to act to get the desired result. And that desired result is security, you see. And the decent people, quote-unquote, seem to be more concerned with this, especially the children. They develop this exquisite ability to tell time, to tell social time, to behave this way when they have to, behave that way when they have to behave street, behave decently, whatever, according to the situation. The thing about the street element is that in general, and again, this is a generalization, and it is an epithet that the decent people use and apply to the street-oriented, but the street-oriented supposedly don't care so much about code switching. Their repertoire is more limited, and so they behave more consistently one way, as opposed to feeling a need to code switch to be decent in the minds of the decent people. They just sort of go through the world being one way. I mean, this is the attitude of the decent people vis-a-vis the mm-hmm. street element, if you see. Mm-hmm. So these two elements are I won't say at war with one another, but they confront one another in the community. So the decent people, as I've said before, who live in the community that is so compromised by unemployment and poverty and the sense that the wider system has abdicated its responsibility in terms of taking care of the community or policing, so many of these decent people are under pressure. You see, they're under pressure. And that pressure sometimes gives way to violence, and whether it's through stray bullets or whatever it is, it's something that really puts a lot of stress on their living conditions.
Yes, the living conditions, housing. One of the things that you see even in that introduction as you go down the neighborhood, the depressed nature of housing and what's happened to houses and the care. There was a time when there was a lot of work being done from the standpoint of the city itself as far as fixing up code enforcement and all those kinds of things. What do you see as far as the concern that people have to try to still make do on these houses, even when they're so run down and infested at times? What happens there? Does that affect?
Well, you see people even in poor neighborhoods who try to keep up their property. They try to do they do the best they can, although clearly they don't have the resources that the middle class has, or even many of the so-called decent people have in the community. And they don't always have the spare money to fix up, to keep up. At the same time, the city is not as interested in code enforcement in some of these communities. Somehow to get the city involved and interested, you need some kind of community organization that has as their business to press the city to observe the codes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, they used to have some strong neighborhood groups that did that quite a few years ago, and they'd march on City Hall. They would sit in. I know they used to sit in because I was on the receiving end of a number of sit-ins on some of those things.
Absolutely.
And it's that strength. Has this communal approach, has that gone, or is it just waning until it can be pulled together again by those who will help to organize some of the responses to these concerns?
I think you kind of indicated it when you said the strong community organizations. And typically in the inner city poor black community, the organizations are not strong. So they don't bring the pressure to bear. And the wider society, the city, becomes more indifferent to their concerns and their needs. When you have a strong community organization, they pressure people and communities to observe certain codes, and they press upon the city the need for this code enforcement, you see. They're concerned about trash pickup. They're concerned about all kinds of things, and they oftentimes get results because the squeaky wheel in this democracy tends to get the oil, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and the neighborhoods where you have the blocks that are really strong blocks, even in poor neighborhoods, you'll find those kinds of people, the elderly, the grandmothers type.
Absolutely.
The women in particular, very strong still. But that needs to be extended beyond that smaller, limited focal point on this.
That's true.
You're listening to University Forum. We're in the second program talking about all kinds of things related to how to make life better for people in inner cities, and particularly the African-American community, where there's been a longstanding problem of poverty and sometimes disenfranchisement. Dr. Anderson, is there a way of laying out a response to some of the issues that we've been talking about? Years ago, there was the Model Cities program, which was aborted so shortly after it started, with the intent of trying to get the community involved and the joint ventures between community and government and private sectors. What's the possibility of any kind or direction? Do you feel anything happening on that positive upswing instead of where we are now? We know what the problems are. We've known. But what's going to be done about all? Who's going to do it?
Well, you have the concerns, of course. It has to be understood that that the city of today is quite different from the city of the Model Cities era. But it's also important to understand that the federal government is different today compared to what it was back in those days. Increasingly, the Congress and the president is elected not by the cities, by the urban areas, but by the suburbs and then the rural areas, you see. And because the constituents are different, and the concerns of those constituents may well be heard before the concerns of others. The people in the inner city don't have, quite frankly, the political clout that they once had. In the days of the big-time mayors like Mayor Daley in Chicago or Adonisio in Newark and various places, you know, those mayors are gone. They don't have the clout in part because the electorate is different, you see. I think what we need in so many of these areas is some kind of a Marshall Plan, you know, for the cities. We need to take the bull by the horns as a government, as a society, and we need to refurbish. We need to employ people in public works jobs. We need to develop these communities. We need to train people to work in the building trades and various other kinds of occupations. We need to put our people to work. And if we can do that, you see, other good things would flow.
Can some of this be done or at least stimulated by the private sector and the middle classes of the African-American community itself?
Well, you're having this to some extent. The various projects like the Nehemiah Project and others that build housing in certain areas of West Philadelphia and that try to employ people from the community. And it's not simply a private organization, but it's a private organization that is getting the benefit of certain grants and things like that. We need perhaps more of that kind of involvement. Increasingly, since the days of Reagan, I think, the private sector has been summoned to do what the government used to do, what the government used to be concerned about doing. More and more, there's privatization, you see, and that has its good points. But I'm not sure that that everything that needs to be done can be done under that rubric. I think we need government involvement more and more because this problem that we see is really a problem that I think cannot be addressed simply by the private sector.
It's a massive problem, and I think that although one might want to say that it's within the African-American community because a lot of it is geographically constrained, a lot of it better be solved if it's not going to really permeate a lot of other aspects of the external suburban area.
Yeah.
And I think that may be incentive, perhaps, for people to begin to look at. You can't just say those people over there.
Right.
It's far too fluid.
Yes.
A situation at this point.
Yes, indeed. And I think, the truth be told, I think we have to appreciate the fact that we are undergoing this profound change from manufacturing to service and high technology, all in the context of an increasingly globalized economy. As I said before, the jobs are moving to non-metropolitan America, and they're moving overseas to developing countries. In fact, our poorest people living right here in Philadelphia are effectively competing with poor people living in China, you see. And so the standard of living in this country may well come down as that in other parts of the world come up. And then this areas here become ripe for investment to the extent that there's a leveling process that makes investment profitable, as it were. So there's a sense in which the factories are not bound to come back until we reach that level.
Yeah.
But that has implications not just for the poor in these communities. Increasingly, it has implications for the middle class. And it may well be that what you see among the poor today represents a kind of a canary in the mine, so that what you see visited on poor communities may well be visited on the middle class eventually.
Well, we've seen something. We've seen some of that already.
The middle class right now is declining.
Yeah.
I mean, if you watch Lou Dobbs's programs on CNN, you get a steady, steady dose of this, and you get a sense of how the middle class is struggling more and more by these structural processes, if you know. And already the poor are being hurt and not really delivered, so to speak. So these things are going on, and so we have to understand that gated communities, cleavages of wealth, a growing number of rich people, a growing number of poor with a small middle class, that may well be our future. So then the question is, what are the implications of all that for understanding what has to be done for cities, you see, in order to make them viable places for human existence?
Well, that's the question. It's the challenge. What we do know is that the so-called middle-class communities have also lost jobs, have been large sectors, and they've leveled off the poor. So part of it may have to do also with restructuring our educational system and how we begin to look at what education really means and
Absolutely.
For whom we train them.
Absolutely.
What do we train them for?
Absolutely.
And if we don't deal with it, what are the other options?
Yeah.
Where do you see yourself going in all the struggle that you've been involved in with what's going on? You were born where?
In the Mississippi Delta.
In the Mississippi Delta.
In deep poverty.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I was born in the Delta during the war. My grandmother was a midwife when I was born. She was very religious. She was a kind of a village doctor. She had all kinds of herbal cures for this and that, whatever. She was a midwife for many, many, many people. And she would only accept food or cakes and things like that, not money. And she had the reputation in the community for being free-hearted. You know, she'd mm-hmm. just give, give, give. And when I was born, she delivered me and given her biblical interests, she named me Elijah. I have a brother named Joseph, in fact. And I was born in the Delta. And during the war, my folks moved to the north. My dad was a factory worker at Studebaker's in South Bend, Indiana. And he had a fourth grade education. My mother worked as a domestic. She had an 11th grade education. And I grew up in the city of South Bend, Indiana, right there, 90 miles east of Chicago, 5 miles south of Michigan. I grew up right there. Mm-hmm. Went to the public schools there and then attended Indiana University in Bloomington. And from there, I went to the University of Chicago. And from there, Northwestern, and then to Swarthmore, and then to Penn. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that's sort of my trajectory.
Mm-hmm. And Swarthmore is a great place to work, too.
Yes, it was. Yeah. That was my first teaching job.
Mm-hmm. I was reading something about Swarthmore the other day. I know the area well. But they were talking about it being so much more diverse, and some of the problems that obtain in other areas that do not necessarily happen in Swarthmore.
Mm-hmm.
But that, one of the big things, though, as you see that change from your life in the Delta, was it within Mississippi itself?
It was in the Upper Delta near Memphis, Tennessee.
Memphis.
About 110 miles to the west of Memphis. It was called the Boot Hill section of Missouri, where that little tip of the boot goes into the Arkansas-Tennessee area, the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Right at the top of the Delta right there. That's mm-hmm. where I was born.
Mm-hmm. Have you been back?
Oh, yes, many times.
Mm-hmm.
Go back about once every 2 or 3 years, at least.
Is family still there? Or
still have family there, extended family.
Mm. Do you see the role of the extended family and the knowledge that people need to have of their background, their roots, as empowering many of the young people today if they should have a way of having that connection?
Oh, indeed. I think that it's quite empowering. We have family reunions about once a year, either in mm-hmm. the South or in the North. And at these reunions, given my own background, it's quite a diversity of people, different styles of life, from people who are educated and well-to-do, a part of this new black middle class, to people who are poor and even members of the underclass, all coming together under one roof.
Mm-hmm.
It might be 50, 60 people all together. And increasingly, this is happening among blacks as they have their family reunions. And what you see being shared here is a peculiar form of social capital, so that the well-to-do can somehow share or teach or connect the not-so-fortunate brethren to what they have in life. because sometimes they want to get away from them too.
Yeah, but
you do see the opportunity for reaching out, and so many of the middle class blacks, the people who have been beneficiaries of this civil rights movement and the incorporation process led by affirmative action, set asides, fair housing, that kind of thing, it's resulted in the growth of a black middle class. And this middle class is more privileged than ever. And with its privilege, it can begin to look back and even serve the poor. And they don't just do this willy-nilly. They're more likely to do this with people who are blood kin to them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So you're seeing some of this, I think, in some of the communities, and spurred on by the emergence of the family reunion, as it were.
Yes. With all that we know is wrong with the structure and all of the impediments that exist, perhaps in changing some of those structural things, it seems that one of the keys that we have to really push is helping the young people to find more of themselves in spite of these barriers.
Right. And I think this is one of the things that you see going on in these reunions, as it were.
Yeah.
You see exposure. You see the poor being exposed to the middle class. You see the middle class reaching back and giving help to the poor oftentimes. And these are their brethren, their family, you see.
The question with the youngsters we've been talking about before, though, those youngsters do not have that linkage. And they may be there, and someone has to help them find that linkage.
That's right.
That you see.
That's right. You may be surprised, but sometimes the people that we're talking about who are in that poor section of the city have connections with people who are well-to-do.
Yes.
You know.
And there are ways that I think need to be built on to use this. We can't necessarily wait until all of the structures are changed. They are formidable.
That's right.
But there are some things I think that we each have to do.
That's right.
And build on as part of that paradigm that'll change things.
That's right.
I'm convinced of that because I think that we within cities or outside of cities have it's an invisible kind of line, but it's crossed over. And areas now that used to be called a lily white and proud of it are no longer that because the not just our own American group, but the many different people from other parts of the world.
That's right. That's right.
Now have come over.
Right. And that is a real plus in many ways because you have such utter diversity, as it were. And it's something that gives some black people pause, but sometimes it sets an example of what you can do. And some people mimic these people making up the diversity, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And become better off themselves as a result of this kind of connection, this kind of contact with other people who are making strides, as it were.
You know, as you were talking about the family reunions, and one of our former deans at the university here at Temple University has been doing this nationally for quite a while now, Dean Ione Vargas. I'm just wondering if there isn't a way that one can begin to sort of simulate this with the young people who are on the streets, and as much as they're trying to get some cred and some respect and all the rest of it, find a different way of doing it. It's hard. I know that. It's not realistic in some ways.
That's right.
But there are some ways that I think we've got
to
move on.
This could be an example, you see.
Yeah.
But certainly not a panacea. Yeah.
Well, I thank you so much for the conversations that we've had. Dr. Elijah Anderson, sociologist who puts his ideas and experiences into action. Thank you for helping to work on this struggle and to help move it to a fulfillment that hopefully will mean some positive outcomes, because otherwise it's a dead-end street.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for having me.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@temple.edu, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.